Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. Our 8 o'clock hour comes from our archives. In April of 2013, we talked about love with an economist. It'll make sense in a few moments. Since this is recorded, we will not be taking any new phone calls or emails today, but thanks for listening. Springtime, when many thoughts turn to love. What are the symbols of love in our culture? Hearts, flowers, music, dollar signs? You'd be surprised about the dollar signs part. Today's guest says attractions and couplings go beyond hearts and hormones. Economic concerns get into the picture. Marina Adshade teaches economics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. 5 years ago, she started a course on the economics of sex and love, which proved quite popular. She now maintains a blog called Dollars and Sex, which has grown into a book called Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Marina Adshade, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Dr. Adshade, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here this morning.
Good to have you. So what non-love and sex economics courses did you or do you teach?
That's a good question. Actually, I'm a economic historian, macroeconomist by training. So I spent a lot of time talking about history and talking about women and women in the workforce. So it wasn't actually that big of a stretch to move over and talk about personal relationships, because once we start talking about women working, you know, then we have conversations about marriage and fertility. So it's not completely unrelated.
And I should point out that there's a certain level of tongue-in-cheekness in your writing and in your blog. This is not all totally dead serious, and you're trying to get away from the economics as the dismal science.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, but the initial impetus to start talking about the economics of sex and love was really just to get people to see economists and economics in a different light. You know, I've always loved economics, and I love the economics approach to the world. But when we teach our undergraduate students, you know, we spend a lot of time giving them the tools they need, but it's not exactly things that students really relates to their own lives. They're important, but, you know, most students aren't spending their time thinking about interest rates and inflation. And so I wanted to teach them a course that said to them, look, you know, all these economics tools that you have or you're learning while you're in university, they actually have real-life applications for you right now. And so I really just wanted to teach them the economics, but to use this approach and hopefully a way that was more engaging for them.
And you got quite a response, as I understand it, when you first offered this course at UBC.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I first started teaching this course, first of all, I proposed it to the dean's office, and I think it went through at lightning speed. They've never approved a course so quickly. And 2 weeks before the course even started in the fall, I was getting media calls from around the world, so it was featured in newspapers in the UK and a Russian newspaper and, you know, a Japanese newspaper covered, which, of course, is really pretty surprising for a new university course. And then the first week of term, the class was about 175 students registered. First week I show up, there had to have been 225 people in the room. So students were sitting on the floor, sitting on the stairs, just wanting to see what the course was like and trying to, if they, you know, it was like a game where if you hold on long enough, hopefully somebody else will drop the course and they could register. So a lot of interest. And, you know, it was an interesting experience teaching that big course because it, you know, there was a few things throughout the term where I realized that this was, I was really connecting with the students. So, for example, I was getting coffee one day and there were some students in front of me in the lineup for the coffee and they turned around to me and they said, you know, you Professor Adshade? And I said, yes. And they said, we love Thursdays in our house because our housemate is in your class. And so every Thursday we wait for him to come back from your class and tell us what he learned that day. And it always leads to a big debate in our house. And I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I'm teaching a class that the students are taking home with them and discussing and thinking about. And I think I take the same approach with the book, you know, is a number of people say this to me, that there's a lot of great conversation starters in the book. And I think that the point of the book is really not to convince people that I'm right. It's just get people have conversations around these topics of love and relationships, but from the perspective that economists take.
Have the discussions and responses of the students assisted your work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I thank my students in the acknowledgments to the book, and I genuinely feel that the students have made a huge contribution, you know, and particularly just their energy, the energy that they bring brought to class with them. You know, it was very encouraging for me. And then from there, you know, of course, I started writing my blog originally as a tool for my students. But it got picked up by Big Think, and it was posted on there. Within 2 weeks of posting on the university website, they picked it up. And then, of course, I also benefited from, you know, thousands of readers who wrote me and wrote me letters and commented on my blogs. And all of this always goes into to the type of work that people like me do, and I don't think it's given enough credit, actually.
One of the names you mentioned first, and this is getting back to economics as the dismal sciences, the name of Thomas Malthus. There's, you know, Malthusian this and Malthusian that. Would you help explain why he's important to this discussion?
You know, Malthus is the one who earned us our name, the dismal science, which I think is a little, I always think is a little bit unfair. But Malthus, he was actually a priest, but he was writing at the end of the 18th century, and he basically said that the economies would never prosper as long as people increased the number of children they had every time things got good. And so, you know, you would have an increase in technology that made farms more productive, for example, and people would have more children, and they would have so many children that, given that, you know, land is constrained, you never see an increase in your well-being. But, you know, poor old Malthus, is, as soon as he said these words, the world around him shifted, because this, of course, is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And as soon as the Industrial Revolution comes along, people actually start having fewer children when they get wealthier. And we've seen that continuation of that trend, which is why we are where we are today with such low fertility rates.
This is a good place to begin the actual discussion, though, of economics and love and sex and how they work together, because it's not just about people looking for people who have money to marry, for example, but it's really about people applying economic principles, often completely unaware, as they approach relationships and situations that could lead to relationships.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the book is not a self-help guide for finding the love of your life by taking the economist approach. That I would never advocate for. And I get asked that if I'm single, and I ask if I apply these in my own life and my own search for love, and that's not really the intention. The intention is to do, as you say, to look at our own lives and the lives of people around us, and actually to look at overall general society and trends in society and decisions that are made at the society level through the economist's lens. And so sometimes that's little things like how we approach online dating, what we write in our profiles, how we make decisions when we're online dating, all the way up to things like how do laws around the funding of contraceptives affect teen pregnancy rates, or how we teach sex education in schools, how that affects teen pregnancy rates. You know, how education of women in university affects marriage rates, and what that says about what's happening in marriage now and moving into the future. So it's a much broader perspective, and talk about a variety of different topics. But the central theme is that economics has something to bring to the table here. It helps us tell these stories in a way that is clear, and helps us abstract away from moral and political debates about these issues, just to look at what we can measure and things we can actually get out of data and give us a theoretical understanding.
So, Marina, one of the key phrases here right up front, the liberalization of sexual values during the 20th century is an economic story, you write. How figure?
Oh, you know, it absolutely is an economic story. I mean, it's generally understood that there's a relationship between contraceptives and the liberalization of sexual values, especially since, you know, it's not just the birth control pill, which becomes legally available in the 1960s, but other contraceptives that come available earlier during the Great Depression and during the Second World War. So you can tell I'm a historian, it comes
right
through in these stories. You know, that's not the whole story. Those things kind of precipitate the change in the market, but it's the market itself that has adjusted, that has allowed for greater promiscuity, especially in a way that has changed the way that we think of around social norms and what we think of as being socially acceptable behavior. And this has had a much bigger impact than just simply, you know, making contraceptives available. And of course, and once you add into there, you know, much bigger increases in women's education rates, especially relative to men, now that women are much more highly educated than our men on average, greater participation of women in the workforce and higher wages for women, that's just an economic recipe for greater liberalization of sexual values.
Well, and for example, and it's, again, I want to make it clear to people who are listening and just tuning in for the first time, we're not just talking about people choosing mates based on things like, well, a person looks like they might make a lot of money down the road, but other economic issues, like the ones that really come to people's lives when they get into mating behavior, which is stuff like the cost of an unplanned pregnancy. That has, in fact, there are a couple of examples that you give in the book, including I believe there's a young woman who you tell the story of who got knocked off track by getting pregnant during her college time.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, the stories in the book are true, and so that story is actually also is a true story, and that's one of the things that has changed a lot, especially in the last 30 years, is that, you know, 30 years ago, if you had just a high school education or you had less than a high school education, you probably earned enough to support both yourself and your family. Over time, the salaries earned to people with that education level have really fallen, not just fallen relative to the rest of us, but they've fallen in real terms. And what that means is there's big costs if your education gets knocked off track, as you say, because you have an unplanned pregnancy. And so that increases the cost of having casual sex, the cost of unprotected sex. And so we're seeing a big shift away from sexual activity for people who are in especially people in high school. I don't think that most people realize we have a tendency to think that teenagers today are very promiscuous, but they're not. Actually, our current set of teenagers are the least promiscuous set of teenagers we've had since the 1970s. There was more promiscuity in high schools when I was in high school than there is now. And that's a direct result, I believe, of the fact that we're getting that the cost of not completing school, the cost of not going on has increased so much that students are very concerned that something's going to happen and it's going to prevent them from being able to support themselves later on in life.
Do you think that is actually a conscious factor in the decision process, though? I mean, do students, I mean, particularly if they're getting drunk at a party, decide at that moment, oh, wait, I'm going to really knock my earnings potential off track if I have a baby?
Okay. Yeah, so are teenagers rationally behaving agents? Obviously not all of them are, and that's why there's the teen pregnancy rate continues to be high, even though it has fallen. But I think that they do make these decisions, and the thing is, they don't even necessarily need to be that proactive. I mean, we can walk around on the street, and we can see the type of lives that other people have, and we can imagine those lives for ourselves. And I think most teenagers realize, you know, when they're in grade 11 or grade 12, that's the end of their educational pursuit. They're not going to have those beautiful houses and the fancy cars. We are very influenced by the conspicuous consumption of others, and they're aware of the people around them and the choices those people have made, and so that does affect people's behavior, and I think that is directly influencing the decline that we've seen in teen pregnancy rates even in the last 10 years.
So we're talking not just about earnings potential, things of that sort, but also opportunity costs, things that you're having to forego if you're spending your money and your time on raising a child rather than advancing your own education and your own earnings potential.
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest opportunity costs that I think that just doesn't get enough discussion is that the marriage rates of people who don't have a university degree have fallen dramatically. They've fallen over 30 percentage points since the 1970s. Which means that if you want to marry as an adult, the best decision you can make is to go to university. And if you want to stay married, the best decision you can make to go to university, because the highest divorce rates is among women who have just a high school education or less. Those women are far less likely to stay married once married, and then when they divorce, they're much less likely to remarry. And so if being married and being in a long-term committed relationship is something that you value, which, frankly, there are so many economic benefits to marrying, it'd be surprising if people didn't think that way. Really, the university education is the best way to achieve that.
You just mentioned divorce rates, which is a major point in the book, because that was one of the jaw-dropping moments, because you take apart the divorce rates and say that they're just reported incorrectly.
Yeah, the economists in general are frustrated by the reporting of divorce rates. So we hear this over and over again. In fact, we've been saying this for so long, it mystifies me, because back in the 1980s, people were saying 50% of marriages end in divorce. 2013, people say 50% of marriages end in divorce. And, of course, since the early 1980s to the present, divorce rates have been falling over the entire period. Divorce rates now are much higher than they were, when we had at-fault divorce rates are much lower now than they were then. And another thing, too, is that people, when you think about it, is this relationship between education and divorce. You know, the divorce rate for people who have a postgraduate university degree, so they have a graduate degree or something like that, the divorce rate for those people is actually incredibly low. I think it's something like 8%, or even lower than that, of those marriages end in divorces. And so it's not this 50% across the board, you know, everybody who walks down the aisle, it's a flip of a coin whether or not your marriage is going to survive. That's not actually true, because divorce rates are much higher for people with less education.
Well, when we get back to education, there's a big correlation here between education and behavior as it relates to relations with people trying to get it on. You use slightly coarser terms in the book, I should point out, that I will not use here on the radio because we need to keep our FCC licenses. But for one of the things you point out is that the cost of higher education in the United States and the teen pregnancy rate have a really interesting correlation.
Yes. So in states that have cheaper access to education after high school, have significantly lower teen pregnancy rates than states that have more expensive college education. The data that's done on that is very convincing, the evidence. And what it suggests is that if the U.S. wants to lower its teen pregnancy rate, which I should point out, even though it's been falling for the last 10 years, it's still four or five times higher than other developed countries, that if it wants to lower its teen pregnancy rates, one of the effective ways of doing that would be to make college education, and it doesn't even necessarily need to be at the university level, but colleges in terms of community colleges and so on, to make those more affordable, because students will respond to the increased chance that they're going to go to school. You know, I talk in the book about a teenager who actually was actually a friend of my daughter's, who I asked him when we were in high school whether or not he was taking the courses that would lead to university courses. And he actually went home and spoke to his aunt who he was living with. And she said, "Why would you take those courses? You're never going to go to college." You know, a lot of students don't anticipate that the college is actually even in the cards just because it's so expensive. And so that tears back into behavior. And so that if you don't ever have an opportunity to go on to school, if you know that finishing high school is the end of the line for you, then those students take more chances, and they're the ones who are more likely to end up being pregnant before high school finishes.
Dr. Marina Adshade is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the author of the book Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love, Economic Principles. We're not necessarily talking about people hooking up because they think the other person has more money. It's a bit broader than that. And normally this is the part where we'd invite you to join our discussion, and we do when the broadcast is live. Today's broadcast is not live. It's a conversation we had several months ago, and so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. So sticking with the subject of college, you say that college campuses are a buyer's market for promiscuous male students. How so?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things, since women are going to university more frequently than are men now, so much so that on U.S. college campuses today, for every 100 male students, there's about 132 female students. So there's far more women on campuses than there are men, and I can see this in my own.
What was the ratio, 100 to 132?
100 to 132.
Wow.
And this is a long time. This started in the 1980s, and so this actually translates through to people. If you look at single people between the ages of, say, 24 and 35, there's far more women with university degrees than there are men with university degrees. And so it creates an educational imbalance that's currently working its way into the older population. But on campuses, it creates an interesting dynamic, because what it means is that women are competing for males on campuses because males are relatively scarce. And that's allowing the preferences of the male students to drive the type of relationships that people are having on campuses. And so that means that there's more casual sex and less traditional dating on campuses where there's more women than there are men.
So much more casual behavior then. People hooking up, basically.
Yeah,
it's not a dating market. That
more of a hookup culture, and there's been some really interesting work done on this, that where they actually go in and survey students on their behavior, but also on what their preferred behavior would be. And you find that women who are, when they greatly outnumber men, they're having to make choices that they would prefer that they were not making because they're competing for men. And this happens in high schools as well. You know, there's usually more grade 12 girls than there are grade 12 boys. And the bigger that gap, the more the preferences of the boys, grade 12 boys are, in driving the type of relationships they have with the girls.
All right, so here really gets to the crux of the whole thing. It really becomes a market-type situation where you've got an imbalance of resources, and in this case, it's an imbalance of men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the kinds of behavior that women engage in that they wouldn't otherwise, so they're engaging in sex where they might not have otherwise? They might have actually preferred a dating culture rather than a hookup culture?
Yeah, that's correct. Or they even for women who are in relationships, they might have preferred that their relationship lasted a little longer without sleeping with the other person. But because it's so competitive, they're entering into sexual relationships with their partners far quicker than they might have otherwise.
You go into a fairly good discussion here about sexual behavior on campus and alcohol with some interesting side notes here, like about alcohol prices and drinking ages and how you think those affect drinking behavior, binge drinking in particular.
Yeah, so I don't know if you listeners realize this, but the presidents of, I think, over 300 universities in the U.S., have been actively petitioning the government to reduce the drinking age because the evidence that the drinking age in the U.S. of 21, I'm a Canadian, right, so we drink a lot earlier here, the drinking age of 21 is leading to a lot of binge drinking on university campuses with some very negative outcomes. One of those is that binge drinking is very closely tied to promiscuity, with all of the costs that go along with that for students, like unintended pregnancies and also higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases. You know, that age group has the highest infection rate of any other age group at the moment. And so there's a good argument there for liberalizing, lowering the drinking age in order to try to prevent the binge drinking because of these very costly for everybody outcomes on campuses.
I ran across both on your blog and in the book the discussion of sugar babies, this analysis about women paying for college through the sex trade.
Mm-hmm.
What analysis is there? Is it fairly widespread or is it still a pretty limited population?
Well, you know, all the evidence that we have on the sugar baby, sugar daddy trend that gets a lot of media attention, it's all being provided for us by websites that are basically, in my opinion, they're the pimps for these relationships. And they actually only present the supply side. So they present numbers on how many women they have signing up to their sites. And that has seen a trend over the last 5 years. There's been an increase in students, mostly because it seems to be popular for students to be willing to at least put their name on the site to see if they can get any additional income from having these relationships with wealthier men. And so that's an apparent. Now, whether or not there's a demand and whether or not the demand has changed, that I don't know, and there's no convincing evidence of that one way or the other. But there's a good theoretical reason why it might be. And then that's it. While sugar babies may be expensive, you know, I think on average people pay about $3,000 a month for a sugar baby, it's still actually a much cheaper form of prostitution than other more traditional forms of prostitution. And so given that the economy has been hurting, given that a lot of people have seen, especially people on the high end, have seen a big hit to their income, it's possible that people are substituting away from more expensive forms of prostitution towards sugar babies that are a less expensive form.
Short break on the Jefferson Exchange. Back to talk more with Marina Adshade about dollars and sex. This is from April of 2013. Back on the Exchange in a minute. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're dipping back into the archives today for an interview from April of 2013 with Marina Adshade about her blog and book, Dollars and Sex. You'll hear Garrison Keillor at the back end of the hour. Right now, let's get back to this interview from a couple of years ago about economics and love and how they intermingle. Now, you've run your students in your coursework through some scenarios about accepting something of value in return for sex. There are some interesting breakouts about where they draw the line on prostitution, you discovered.
Yeah, so the way that I do that is I start by saying, you know, when a woman is given cash in exchange for sex, is that prostitution? And the students all nod their head and say, yes, it is. And then I say, well, if a woman can't pay her rent and has sex with her landlord instead, is that prostitution? And the students all nod their heads. And I say, if a woman goes to on a trip to New York for a weekend with somebody and has sex with him just because he's paying for the trip, is that prostitution? And then you start getting a divide in the students. And then I ask them, we work our way down. Eventually I say, you know, if a man stands in a bar and buys drinks for a woman all night, and she goes home with him because she feels obliged because he's been paying for her drinks, is that prostitution? And this is where we see a really big gender divide, because the male students will often perceive that as prostitution, but the female students will not. And that often leads to an interesting discussion in my classes, because it's actually not that straightforward to define prostitution. And when we look at it, it's easy to see that there is various state times in our own lives when we've been engaged in behavior that is, strictly speaking, could be perceived as prostitution. And this takes us back to the sugar babies, because I often have conversations with people who say, well, it's not really prostitution. But 85% of their relationships on the websites, and that's from the person who runs the website themselves, 85% of those relationships involve exchange of sex for money.
You'll notice some phone calls and emails referenced in this broadcast. They are from the original broadcast of this hour several months ago. Since it is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Before we get away from the question about prostitution, let's go to Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Marina Adshade.
Well, good morning. You were touching on the prostitution aspect, and I'd like to return to that. My other statement and comment was about 4 years ago, Sony distributed a presentation over the internet, and they described in 15 minutes how technology was racing so far ahead of any educational system's ability to process it or even distribute it. For example, one of their statements was that any high-tech educational term that young people spend, let's say in a 5 or 6 year university course, halfway through or two-thirds way through, the information that they're being taught will be obsolete. So that was quite revealing. Could you elaborate how that would impact sexual mores in regards to high technology? I think you already did. I'm sorry I got on late. My other question is the prostitution. How does prostitution rank now? I listened to the part where your students were having discussions. Are you seeing a change in the meaning of prostitution, or do you expect that to change? And I can take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Well, those are two good questions. Let me just start with the second one, is that we're having more conversations about prostitution, and I think that it's important that we have these discussions and we understand something about, particularly about the lives of the women and men who you know, use this as their form of income. Just like all other sexual values, we were more accepting of prostitution now than we were in the past. But having said that, and this is something that is interesting, is that as our national incomes increase, we actually have less prostitution. So, you know, back when Kinsey did his report in the 1930s, I think something like 70-80% of men would have had sex with a prostitute at some point in their lifetime. Those numbers are down now. I think they're down to about 19% of men. So there is a relationship between economic growth and the prevalence of prostitution. So even though it might be becoming more accepted, the thing is that alternatives to prostitution are also becoming more accepted. So it's much easier to have casual sexual relationships than it was in the past. And I think that that's what's really going to drive our perceptions about prostitution, is the access to the alternative, which is just, you know, casual sexual relationships. In terms of the first question, my courses don't become obsolete halfway through. And I think that's because so much of what we teach in economics is about economic theory, rather than teaching people about technology. But technology is definitely driving the way that we have our relationships. So getting back to what I just said about prostitution may be following, but actually access to technology that smooths that market, so being able to use services like Craigslist and other online dating services to meet with sex workers has really increased the supply of sex workers on the market. So any increases we're seeing of men and women going into the sex trades is being fueled by new technologies that smooth the transition. So my students tell me that they have apps on their phone that are meet-up apps, so you can see if anybody who's nearby you can meet up. They tell me that on my campus there are many, many sex workers, so that they see them on their meet-up apps. So they might be hanging out in the student union building, just hoping to connect through this technology. And so technology is going to drive a big increase in the supply, and that will continue because it makes it so much easier to do these jobs without being risk of caught and without all the negative consequences that go along with being caught doing them.
That's really interesting, though, because there really are economic principles at work here then, because then you've got a greater supply of people, a greater supply of workers in this trade because they think they can make a buck at it.
Yeah, correct. And, you know, when you get a bigger supply, that drives down the prices. And so when it drives down the prices, it potentially draws more buyers into the market.
So more demand and more supply.
More demand and more supply.
Let's talk about the slightly more uplifting version of people hooking up online, which is the whole online dating phenomenon. You explain in the book thick and thin markets. Can you tell us what those are and which of those online dating tends to be?
Yeah, online dating is an interesting market to study because unlike other markets, like the market we just talked about, online dating doesn't have money to smooth the transition. It's much more like a barter economy. So if I want to have a relationship with somebody, not only do I have to find somebody that I want to be with, somebody who has all the values or that has the value in an economic sense, has the qualities that I'm searching for in a mate, but I also have to find somebody who wants me as well. And so we need to rely on what economists call the double coincidence of wants. And so those are more difficult markets. And then to make that even more difficult is that markets historically have been very thin. So when you have thin markets, there's not very many buyers or sellers. And so then you have to accept that you're not going to find the perfect person. And if you want to marry, then you're going to settle early in your life. I think about what the market was 50 or 60 years ago, the person that you were likely to marry would be the person who was in your high school graduating class or living in the town that you were living. And these are very thin markets, and people settle early in those markets. And they don't spend a lot of time searching for the perfect person. Online dating, and actually, I should say, more importantly, social networking sites are making the markets much thicker than they were in the past. And thick markets mean that people search longer, but they end up with people who are more along the lines of the people that they're searching for. And one of the interesting implications for that is that over the whole time that we've had access to online dating, which is almost 15 years now, the divorce rate has been falling. And so while we might have this perception that people are using sites like the Madison site to have affairs and the online dating is responsible for infidelity and divorce, that's not evidence in the data. Evidence in the data is that online dating actually reduces the divorce rates because people wait longer to go into the relationships and they find better quality relationships than they did in the past.
Now, an interesting sidelight here. Singapore regulates online dating. How?
Oh, well, you know, the marriage rates are so low in some of the Asian countries. And Singapore is not the only one. And their fertility rates are so low that the government has stepped in and tried to get the market flowing. And so they have all sorts of programs. So, for example, online dating in the U.S. is an online service that is provided by the government. But that's not the only service they provide. One of the things they introduced a couple of years ago, and I need to follow up because I'd love to know how this worked out, is that they started training matchmakers. So say that I was married and I was hoping to see my friends become married. I could go take a weekend course that was provided by the government that would teach me, you know, the ethics of matchmaking and how to get people together and how to make good choices in an attempt to try to encourage people to marry, because people there are working. They're spending a lot of time in school. They spend a lot of time investing in their careers. And what that means is they're postponing marriage for so long that by the time they do marry, they're having either none or only one child. And so there's long-run implications for the society as a whole.
Did you find any sort of worldwide figure at which people have postponed marriage too long, like an optimum age at which people get married?
Well, you know, I've never seen anything that is an optimum age for people to marry. On a worldwide basis, the one thing I'll say is this, is that if you look at the probability that somebody's been married by the time they're 45, that probability has actually not fallen over the last 30 years, and it's even increased slightly in the last 10 years, which means that people are marrying, even though that we think that our marriage rates have fallen. That's because people marry later in life and because they divorce, and so they spend periods of their life single. But by the time people are 45, most people have married. So people are continuing to marry, but they're doing it a little bit later. Actually, there's some new research that doesn't appear in the book that says that online dating is actually encouraging people to marry a little bit younger. So people in their 20s who meet online are marrying at an earlier age than people who didn't meet online. But in terms of the optimal age, I mean, that's just bounded by the number of children that you want to have and your own constraints on your fertility. So if people are going to continue on the current trend of having these very small families, then people don't have as much of an incentive to marry earlier. And I think this is one of the biggest determinants of when people marry. It's the constraints on their fertility and the number of children they choose to have.
Today's broadcast does include some phone calls and emails from the original broadcast of the program, but that was several months ago. It is pre-recorded today, not live. Therefore, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Let's take another call. We have Phyllis in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Marina Adshay. The book is Dollars and Sex.
Hello. My question really, I think, relates closely to what was just being talked about that I didn't hear very well because I was on the telephone with you. But it related to tracking the actual marriage rate. And I heard you say that people tend to be with online dating services and so forth, tend to be marrying later than they are. And so it's probably too soon to be tracking divorce rates among some of these people, and I do wonder if there's any statistics about the actual marriage rate of people, in marriageable age, than there has been in the past.
All right, thanks for that, Phyllis. Appreciate it.
Well, you know the peak time of length of time of marriage for divorce is 3 years. So it doesn't take very long for us to get a sense about how long marriages are lasting, because believe it or not, if you make it past the 3 or 4 year mark, you have a much lower chance of divorcing. The whole idea of the 7 year itch is actually false. It's really more like a 3 or 4 year itch. So it's not really too soon to see the relationship between meeting people online and divorce rates. I'm trying to remember what the second part of the question was, sorry. And in terms of marriage rates, the way that we usually track these things, because you don't actually have to meet your partner online to have the online market making an effect. I would never suggest, for example, that if you met somebody online, you're going to have a higher quality relationship with somebody that you met at a friend's place at a dinner party. It's just the fact that that market exists, and the fact that people have larger markets on which to search. It encourages more thorough searching, and it encourages people to set the minimum requirements they want for a mate at a higher level. This is true for other markets, too. For example, we've seen a transition as we moved away from, we have much more interracial dating now than we had in the past. And when we had more relationships that were just same-race relationships, people actually were thinning their own markets. Once you open your markets up by race, the markets actually become thicker, even without having new technologies like online dating. And so having more interracial marriage actually should also improve the quality of marriages.
Well, when you think about online dating as a market, it begins to seem, particularly in the context you just gave, that it is more like an economic activity in the sense that you're placing more requirements on it, like you're buying a washing machine or a car, because you want to make sure that, okay, I want to make sure I have bucket seats, I want, I want a full stereo, and all the things that you would look for in a car. Obviously not all the same things, but you see what I'm saying? That you're laying out in advance the expectations that you have when you might not have those if you just bump into somebody and get attracted.
Yeah, I know. And actually what you say is one of the things that people do when they go online is they get overwhelmed by the amount of choice because there are so many people on that market. And so because they find that exhausting, they start thinning their own market, so to speak. They start narrowing their markets because they find it too time-consuming to search. And so they do exactly what you just said. you know, they're not, may not be saying that they want bucket seats, but they're saying, I'm only going to consider people who are over 5'8". I'm only going to consider people who list their education the same as mine, or who report to being thin and athletic. And so people thin their markets when they do that. And this is an interesting phenomenon because, of course, people didn't, in the past, didn't put as much weight on these things. You know, I might go to a dinner party and I might meet somebody who I find charming and interesting to be around. And I wouldn't be sitting there saying, you know, but I think he's 5'7½" and not 5'8". You know, I'm not going to cut him off at that level. And so we do thin our markets a little bit, but, you know, once people search long enough, I think they stop doing that because they realize how much it restricts. And a lot of the online dating sites that we have now that have these algorithms, those algorithms actually are an attempt to defeat our self-thinning behavior on our markets.
Oh, they're adjusting back what we tried to adjust out.
Yeah, they are. They're trying to correct people's own behavior. That is the role of the algorithms, is because really, you are your own worst enemy when you start limiting your searches, especially getting back to women in education, is women who are saying they're only going to date somebody who has equal or greater education than themselves. That's just not possible like it was in the past.
Wow. So many more questions and no time in which to ask. Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love, the book, Dr. Marina Adshade, its author, our guest. Thank you so much for joining us on the exchange today.
It's been great.